Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader. Today, our guest is Nathan Englander, author of Kaddish.com, published by Knopf tomorrow, the 26th. Nathan also will be speaking and reading from Kaddish.com at the Free Library in Philadelphia, as most of us know it, on Wednesday, March 27th at 7:30 p.m. You can visit the Free Library website to purchase tickets. You can just type Philadelphia Free Library into Google and you'll get it. Or you can go to our website, WellingtonSquareBooks.com, and you'll find a link to it. Nathan is the author of Dinner at the Center of the Earth, the collection What We Talk About When We Talk About Anne Frank, the best-selling story collection for the relief of unbearable urges, and the novel The Ministry of Special Cases. He's also the recipient of the Frank O'Connor International Short Story Award and a finalist for the 2013 Pulitzer Prize. His work has appeared in The New Yorker, The New York Times, The Atlantic, The Post, as well as in many collections of the Best Of series, which we have each one in the bookstore. They're great. So it's Best of Short Stories. And he's the writer in residence at NYU. Kaddish.com is a story of a complicated man, a tortured man, a man whose love is transcendent, as is his guilt and shame. Because he neglected his duties as a good son after the death of his father, he's failed as a good Jew, even though he attempted to rectify his lack of fortitude and gratitude by participating in a scheme that goes wrong, goes awfully wrong, and he spends a great deal of his time as a converted man in trying to make good the promise that he had willfully broken years before. Whether he succeeds or not is for you to find out, unless Nathan tells you at the library. So anyway, welcome, Nathan, and thanks so much for joining us today.
Oh, thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
You know, it's so funny, when I was reading the book, in the beginning, I kind of liked Larry. I liked Larry because, you know, he spoke his mind, he didn't take any crap from anyone, and he made up his own mind about things. So did you like him then, before he moved on?
Oh, I do. I've only just started talking about the book, but it's been as a writer, you start to see, again, it's like wonderful to start getting feedback, but I'm interested in, I'm on your side. It's interesting how people respond to his rebellious streak. But yeah, I really feel, I mean, that's what drives a book like this. You know, every book is character driven, but this one really specifically, or this type of novel, like, really, it's about Larry, who becomes Shuli when he goes back to his roots, which is, as we talked about spoilers, that's as far as I'll spoil it. But yes, I guess I connect to him. It's not a big leap from certain choices I've made in my life as someone who comes from a religious family and is very secular. So I very much understand where he's coming from, and fiction makes room for you to be maybe a little more explosive than you'd necessarily want to be at a family mourning.
Yeah, I know. It brought me back to my Jewish roots and my bar mitzvah and my father's death and lots, and the Artsite candle, and just it really resonated with me. But, you know, also...
Thank you.
To not spoil it, I won't even say the word that comes before Shuli. So, and I like him a lot, too. Even though he's like such a goofball in a way, until he's not. But you do like him. It's just that he's kind of a lot like me. He's just the kind of a person that you want him to say, "Why don't you just do this already?" Like his wife says. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Okay. I'm glad you bring up Miri, because that's this certain. You know, I'm alone in a room all day, and I'm trying to keep my dog quiet right now. She's a good girl, but so not so alone. She's often with me. But, you know, there's these moments when you're just working in silence and drafting your way through a book where, like, there's these just tectonic shifts that happen. And I really feel like there was the moment where Miri becomes who she is in the book, becomes the character that she is and the person that she is, that the whole thing came together. Because that's, you know, it's different people are looking for guidance in this book. There's so much about being lost and trying to find oneself and looking for a direction and all that stuff. And he really gets it, you know, maybe mirroring my own relationship, who knows, but it's really his wife that he looks to. She really is the rock in their relationship. And yes, when he doesn't have the oomph himself, she's the one who, you know, helps steer him on his path.
Yeah, and sometimes it seems like it's in an obfuscatory way, but then he realizes when he sits down or goes to bed, he realizes, oh, that's what she meant, and or that's how I feel about her, or thank goodness that's how she feels about me. But one of the questions I would ask you, and if you think this is a spoiler, you don't have to answer it, the transition from Larry to Shuli, how did it happen?
Oh, so, you know, I sometimes, when I think about the genesis of story, or when you talk about story, you know, I have the good fortune to, you know, get to go on the road and to get interviewed and talk about books. There's a lot of, you know, high-minded ideas and really serious ideas and metaphysical ideas and really heartfelt, you know, complicated reason and pathological reasons that a novel gets written or a story gets told that I can really unpack and really mean. And then sometimes there's just, you know, there's also this, like, simple joke to it, like an impetus, you know, the execution of an impossible joke. Like, that's, you know, like one of my early stories, Reb Kringle, is about, you know, a Hasidic guy with a big belly and a long white beard who, you know, doesn't have enough money to pay for his synagogue, so he has to work as Santa Claus. You know, to me, that's literally a straight up joke. Like, the idea for that story, I was like, oh, you know, it's just a joke, but what if I tried to tell it with great empathy? What if I wrote this? Is it a serious story? I was like, there's no way to make it a serious story. Like, that can be the birth of a story. And for me, you know, I get teased a lot because I'm so radically secular and I'm always screaming about how irreligious I am. And everybody is like, but you're also the most religious person in the world. You know what I'm saying? Like,
yes.
I think my wife is never sure she's going to open the door and find me, that I'm going to, like, have that, you know, like my Hasidic character, have a beer to the floor and, you know, pay us down to my ankles and have koshered the kitchen while she's gone. So I was really thinking about that notion of change. Like, I'm someone who grew up super religious. And just, yes, it took years, but it's also the flip of a switch where I was like, oh, I'm not a religious person, and I left that world. But, you know, back to the joke part of it, or the one-line idea of it, I was like, well, if I switch one way, and that seems so normal and so inevitable and so clearly who I'm supposed to be in this life, like, that's also in me. You know, friends are always teasing me about those, like sort of my tendencies or my religious mindset. It's so patterned in my brain. And I was like, well, how weird is it if I switch one way? Like, why wouldn't I just one day switch the, like, why wouldn't I just switch back? How abnormal would that be? So, yeah, that really, it can be that simple as an idea for a book. I was religious and now I'm secular. What if I switch back? And I think that a novel can form right out of that.
Yeah, and it's those kinds of schisms or sea changes that are great for readers because they can fill in the blanks and they can form their own opinion of, I wonder what happened. And it's a nice feeling because it's like you're afloat and you don't know, but you're allowed as a reader to kind of like hook the things together.
I wish I had. I'm not one of those people. I just saw a note from Colin McCann in my email today. Like, he's so good at remembering quotations. I'm like, so right now I have a idea of a John McPhee quote in my head, but I can't tell you the quotation at all. Oh, but anyway, I'm such a huge believer in those negative spaces, in elision, in those absences. I think that's what makes reality. So I can't even tell you how much as a reader that's what I believe in, and as a writer, like, just, you know, I say it, you know, whenever it comes up, but this notion of you and I talking, what makes it real is we're absent each other's whole lives. It's so nice to meet you, but like you and I are having a conversation and there's infinity missing. And it's sort of that absence and the two of us coming together that makes it interesting for me, that has me engaged, and also that makes it real. If we filled in every missing part, like you and I would become a construct. So I just love those, you know, white spaces on the page.
Yeah, I know. It's like when I do these, and I've done over 500 of them, it's like you may not even exist. You may be a manifestation of something.
That yeah, right. It's like literally that. Like we connect out of nowhere, and here we are. You know, like I'm all lit up right now, and I feel like that's the same thing that should happen on the page. You should just be engaged and lit and using your brain to fill in. You know, the example I use also is like there's always, you know, there and we don't have any time to get into the fact that there is such a thing as truth, but there's also versions of a story, you know, that connect to the truth more, you know, like when you're talking about opinion or, you know, a stance, like that's it. If you hear about a couple, you know, breaking up, there are multiple sides to that, you know what I'm saying? Sometimes more than two, but it's not just, it's about, we always have to fill in the story. You could say like, oh, you know, those two are getting divorced, and you can even have the story, but you have to bring yourself to it, you know, and that's what a novel should ask, is for you to bring yourself to it, to like engage, to be an active part of that telling.
Yeah, and that negative space works in all the arts, whether it's photography or music, like this, like the pause in the Beach Boys' Good Vibrations. You know, it's
that's awesome. I saw them at Jones Beach Theater in I don't know what year.
Yeah, you're probably like me. I did too. So back to the book, because we want to sell books. So it's a book about Judaism, so much so, and we talked about this a little bit before the show, that a good part of it is based on the actual Hebrew language and its idiomatic structure. So if the reader doesn't have an iPad, which was great because I could just press the word, and amazingly, Wikipedia and the translation part was great. It gave me this great detail. So if you don't have an iPad or a Kindle, what do you expect the reader who's reading a real book, which I shouldn't say Kindle when I own a bookstore, but what do you expect the reader to do to understand this so much of the Hebrew that's in the book?
That's an easy answer for me, and which is it's just how we read, like everything. I mean, I've thought about this for, you know, more than 20 years, which is you're telling a story. I'm owning this world and I'm sharing this culture. It better be universal or it's not functioning. So yes, if you have the option to click on something because there's a clickable link, that's awesome. But that's, you know, that's not how we read the physical book. Like you read through it, it's everything is there in context. Everything is there in the moment.
Right.
You know, everything will feed you what you need at the right moment, or I have utterly failed you as an author. So yes, you can do, and I thank you for that kind of read. If you want to go say like, oh, what does this mean? Where did this come from? But I always say like, you know, if you can read science fiction, you know, I say like, call this dystopian kosher. You know what I'm saying? Like, just read through it. That's how, you know, we're always reading things that are foreign to us and always reading things that are different to us. And I think it's only certain times, you know, where you'll be like, oh, this is, you know, maybe someone will be like, oh, this is, you know, very Jewish. Can I read this? But they won't say like, oh, can I read about Offred in The Handmaid's Tale? Because I've never been in a Handmaid's Tale situation. It's like, you can follow along. You'll be fine. So, yes, my belief, it is on the author to unpack for you and to say, you know, if he ate a piece of matzah, you know, and it's a little dry, you're like, okay, you know, if it's, you know, he's not, it's not, you know, like, it's probably a food. He put it in his mouth. You know what I'm saying? It's like those kind of notions. I feel like you contextually must walk the reader through and help with the things that need helping without either over-explaining or selling yourself short or, you know, breaking down what doesn't need to be broken down. So, yes, I really hope if you had a different experience, you know, if you're reading a hard copy, that you should fly right through. You know, I built this book in a really specific way, like I was really thinking about pacing, but I really did want this to be almost like an unbroken experience, the unbroken dream kind of novel, like where someone would sit down in a chair and actually like read the whole thing in that way.
Yeah, and I
not that everyone, not that everyone's text messages aren't going off at night, you know, and everyone's getting interrupted in our modern world. But yes, it was, really built that way for you to go laugh, 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 cry.
Yeah, and I can honestly say there wasn't a gap, even though I looked them up, but there wasn't a gap that wasn't filled on either side by the context. So you didn't lose anything. You gained a little bit more when you translated, but you didn't lose anything because there wasn't that gap in context.
Well, it's also like I think, you know, what I believe in is like I love when you're building a reality that it has to have those facets in it. So, you know what I'm saying? Like when I read, you know, when I'm chewing my way through Cormac McCarthy and like devouring those books, they read, you know, beautifully to me. But had I, you know, been on more than like a pony ride at the fair, like I assume the horse stuff would read differently if I knew my horses. You know what I'm saying? So
exactly.
I feel like, yes, this goes like, you know, for me, I'm like dig deep into the idea of, you know, Shaliach Mitzvah and what it is to like have an emissary who's, you know, tasked with something and what a kinyan is. And, you know, to me, I'm like, you know, obsessed with these, you know, concepts of Jewish law. So yes, if you're really into, I don't know what, if you're really into Jewish contractual law, you know, that'll be in there for you somewhere down deep, but it should not distract, you know, the reader who's not interested in the machinations of, you know, what happens when you sell your chametz on Passover.
My daughter, when she was little, Annie, since I own a bookstore, I have a first edition of Finnegan's Wake, but I also had a paperback one that had a boy blowing a bugle on the cover. And Annie and I would get into bed at night. She was like 4 or 5, and she would call the book Pretzel Boy because the bugle looked like a pretzel.
And that's funny.
And we would read it. This goes back to what you're saying. We would read it, and I would read it aloud, not to anybody but her, in an Irish accent. And then she would read it. And obviously, you can pick up Finnegan's Wake anywhere, because no one knows what it means. And she would read it, and just by reading it, even though we didn't know what it was, you could tonally interpret it. And she was doing this at 5 years old with a book that's incomprehensible. So
that's awesome.
I know, it was awesome. And she's a great, she's great at that.
But, now, I don't know if anyone's written it, but I'll race it. But now I want to do a children's book called Pretzel Boy. That's a good title.
Okay, give me credit, please. I like that title. So anyway, back to the book. Why don't you, because I could spoil it, why don't you tell the reader and the listener here, what is it that Larry does that later Shuli is trying to undo? The main theme of the story.
So, yes, Larry comes from a Orthodox, capo, small c, conservative, you know, a very religious Jewish family. He is the only person who would be responsible to say the prayer for the dead for his father, who has just passed away. And according to, you know, religious Jewish law, like the person's soul in the world to come is being judged, and that you need an advocate on this earth to pray for you. And that would mean going to 3 minyanim, going to like a group prayer 3 times a day and saying this prayer 8 times a day for 11 months without missing once. Like people do not a joke, people do not miss not once in 11 months. And you really, this is like really to spare you from the, you know, hellfire sort of thing, to make sure your soul ends up in a good place. And he is the only one tasked with this. And he's not a religious guy. He's just not going to do it. It's a crazy giant responsibility, you know, to ask of someone who is just not religious. It's just not going to happen, and it's making his sister crazy because she is worried about, you know, their father's soul. And so what he does is he figures everything's online now, and he looks around for it, and he finds a site called Kaddish.com, and he hires a proxy to say the prayer for him. And then that's the first section of the book. And basically, when he becomes religious again, he recognizes the what he has done, and in a sense, you know, that he's sort of given away his birthright, and he wants it back. And that is the journey of the book, is him trying to put things right.
Yeah, then it becomes a detective story in a way. Hey.
Yeah, sort of, yes. He's on a great search trying to get back the thing that he feels is most his.
So do you know anyone in your real life that rolls her eyes like his sister does? Seems like you do.
That's funny. Nobody popped into head. I feel like so many of these things now. My sister's in town. She's coming over today. I'll ask my sister and wife who to point the finger at. But yes, more and more as things go on, I feel like this is a personal thing. So many writers, they write really, really close earlier in their career, and as they get their like fictive muscles going, they start to write more and more distance. But for me, we're really, my family is super, super private. We're really private people, and I feel like I would always write distant to get close. You know, so my story about being, you know, the 27th man, about like me exploring my dream of being a writer, I set that in a Stalinist work camp in 1952. You know, that's where I went to get close. But I feel like as I get older, it's the opposite. I more and more am like, I can see myself drawing off, you know, people in my life in that way. I know that, you know, and what we talked about when we talk about Anne Frank and that story, I know that hand on the knee is my wife. Like, that one I can see.
Mm, that's cool.
But, yeah, the eye roll escapes me now, but, you know, maybe I'll put it on my wife, not my sister.
Well, you know, I went to GoDaddy, and Kaddish.com is actually available if you want to buy it for $69.95.
They are not selling it for that. Trust me, I've tried to buy it so many times, or the, like, the, yeah. That's like the first bid or something. They're not letting it go.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I know that works.
Yeah, I want that so bad. I was like, I wrote the book. Like, all I wanted. We have the site, which is actually kind of funny, or it actually in the way life works or the way I see the world. We have kaddish.com.com, which is kind of funny to me.
That's perfect. Yeah.
Yeah.
There are actually services that do exactly what he contracted Chemi to do, right? I mean, in real life.
So I knew, you know, this is, I love my mom for this. She's anything that's related to a book. But yeah, within like, as soon as she'd read a draft, I don't know how long after, like she tore something out of the back of like Jewish Week or something and be like, your service exists. But I didn't know they were formalized, but I did know it is a perfectly kosher, and it is a long-standing thing, like, because if you think about the import, you know, which is what we're talking about, like what this novel rests on, this is not a joke. You know what I'm saying? If you respect people's beliefs, like, if you know, you believe in the afterlife and heaven and hell, like the idea that your soul is going to suffer if you don't have someone to pray for you, that's gigantic. Like, it's not going to be extraordinarily rare that someone's going to have a family where someone's not going to be trusted to do their job. So yes, I did know, you know, the tradition itself of being able to hire a yeshiva student or someone like that to say Kaddish, or if someone to cover for you, that is, you know, pretty ancient. So
okay.
So that part, you know, me, you know, digitizing it, I figure everything has become, you know, internetable, and you know, everything can be found through Google these days. That was the leap for me. But yes, now now people are going to come out of the woodwork with actual versions. Which once again, I mentioned the whether it makes the final cut. But I mentioned my story, you know, Reb Kringle, and that's one of the things I learned early on as a writer. As soon as I wrote about a Jewish Santa Claus, I can tell you in the last 20 years of like touring around this country, I think I have met every Jewish Santa Claus in America, and they are legion. So I know again and again, if you dream it, if you write it, you'll find out, like, you know, I think if you're fortunate, you know, like, it's going to have happened in this world.
Maybe it's like 40% of Nobel Prizes go to Jews, maybe 40% of
Santa Claus.
Jews.
Probably. So there's surely a correlation. You can win a Nobel Prize on economics if you can do that model. You can prove that.
It's funny. What's funny, another funny thing in the book is the way that Larry has to deal with these computers that are kind of, we look at them now as being ancient, and then when he gets to know Gavriel, he's so amazed that he can actually navigate, but obviously Gabrielle does a much better job at it. But it's interesting to think about how different things were even 15 or 20 years ago or less.
Oh, it's I love... it's always a delicate, everyone's careers are delicate, but writing is a especially scary business. But I think if I had to have another job, I think I would love to do a continuity on like a movie set. you know, I love, you know, just mapping time and place and where everything was. But writing today, when you try and, you know, if you're writing anything contemporary or that like spans even a 10-year period, just trying to track the technology is really interesting and so much work.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Like, literally, I have to be like, wait a second, 1999, was that, you know, you have to be like regional and then, you know, just trying to figure out, like, was it dial-up? Was it a phone line? Did I have DSL? Was it Ethernet? Like, it's just crazy when you think of how fast things have changed. You know, it's pretty unbelievable what's happened, technologically. There's a lot that's unbelievable, some of it terrifyingly so. But on the good front, there's the advances in computing are just, they've been so fast.
Yeah, the only hook I have is Windows 98. I can... Because I know it was 98, but other than that, yeah.
Oh, that's funny.
What I was going to ask you was about the dreams are so important in this book, both for Larry and for Shuli. And it's interesting how this is something that, again, as I said earlier from somewhere else, it kind of threads through the book. And those dreams are so, I don't know, motivating. For both of those characters, and
yeah, that's so. Yeah, that sends my head spinning. So, dreams are really delicate in fiction, and I think you often have to deal with, you know, dreams are really delicate in fiction. I feel like you often have to like break your own rules. Like a fiction is a, you know, needs to be a dream turn reality, and then it's like a dream inside of a dream, but it gets to the rules of a world, and this is a religious world, and in the religious world, and this is a religious world that, you know, part of the book takes place, you know, in Jerusalem, and there's certain places and certain people where dreams play a different role. And I grew up, you know what I'm saying, if you are a religious kid, like, this is literally like messages from God. You know, dreams have real import and contained real meaning. And that, for me, in this book, allowed me to, you know, engage with dreams as their own kind of reality. You know what I'm saying? Like, not,
sure.
Not just, you know, a made-up thing inside a made-up thing, but I'm saying a reality inside a reality. And that's really, you know, how I was raised, and I think a certain kind of weight is the portent of dreams, you know, 7 years of, you know, good times and, you know, and then the famine to come, you know, like that's, you know, that stuff is, you know, really, really clear to me.
Yeah. It's like, this is kind of sad, I guess, but it's a seminal dream that I had. And what it was I had this big house, but there was this room in this house, which is real Freudian, that I didn't know existed. And this guy came in, and he looked like Gandalf. He had the beard, the hat, he
yes.
had the cloak and the staff, and he, like, tapped on this door, and it opened, and inside was this beautiful library with these Moroccan red, blue, green titles all set nicely with their spines out, and absolutely beautiful books. And he took his staff, and he waved it around the room, and he looked at me, and he goes, "All this could have been yours." And that was it.
That's
didn't make me happy, but that was the dream.
That's hysterical. And there's certain patterns of dreams. Like, I love talking to New York. It's funny because it's, you know, that's a real estate kind of dream. But there's a lot of people, and I always wonder if it happens to people in, like, you know, high density, stressful, you know, where, like, it's so expensive to live in New York. But so many friends here have dreams about, like, discovering extra rooms that they use in their house, like, frustrated. Like, I've talked to so many people. There's a dream, like an anxiety dream that multiple friends have had, where it's like you open a door and you find out you had an extra, like, floor to your house, and you're like, God, I wish I'd used that. Anyway.
Yeah. Well, it's supposed to be your subconscious,
yeah.
I guess.
You had the Gandalf, but I feel like it's a form of, like, real estate threat dreams.
Well, the other dream that he has, which may be the most important one, is the one that's like Sartre's No Exit. And I also had a dream like that, too, where you were on this, in my case, it was this strand of dark, dark beach with a dark, dark sky, and I knew I was there alone, and I would be alone forever, forever, and it was just like, you know, it would be like hell. And Larry has a dream that seems like that, but then kind of unseems like that, you know, with the last door.
Well, there are the things that go along with religion that are, you know, there are the books, there's what's written down, and then there's the metaphors that we attach to things and how they are used, you know, to educate, to instill wonder or instill fear and keep order. I'm very interested in that. Obviously, as a writer, I, you know, deal in metaphor. So, yes, we got a lot of ideas of heaven and hell when I was growing up, and they were really sometimes wonderful and often very alarming. And I get really interested in, how we use these metaphors, and that's one of the things the book explores, are these ideas of, you know, heaven and hell. Some of them, you know, it's just, I can even, you know, say that they're short, but it's like, you know, that heaven and hell, you know, they're often the same place in these Jewish metaphors. You know, it's the same room as both heaven and hell. So, you know, it could be like you're a kid and you're sitting at a table and you have the Bible in front of you to study. And if you're a good boy, studying the Bible for eternity is heaven. And if you're like an itchy, naughty, bad boy, to sit in front of a Bible for eternity is hell. You know what I'm saying? That's the kind of stuff they'd, you know, line up before us. And you know, really, some of them were, you know, just alarming to a teenager. They'd be like, you know, the world to come is you watching a movie of your life with God sitting on one side and your mother sitting on the other. You know, try that with a teenage boy. It's quite an upsetting notion. But yes, there were a number of these that would be doled out to us.
Yeah, and it was like this table with this, you know, your table, Larry's table, Shuli's table, with this beautiful repast of every wonderful food you could ever have, and the table is endless, as his father says. And then there's also a table that's completely empty. And, you know, in the readers, at least this reader, you know, it's kind of like a really weird kind of topsy-turvy feeling, much like you were just talking about, and much like you were talking about in terms of the idiomatic Hebrew that you use, where one word can mean one thing and you just change it a little bit and it means something completely different.
Yeah, I'm a little obsessed, having, you know, grown up in a black and white world. I'm really obsessed with gray space, or the way, you know, just tiny shifts that things can be everything and their opposite. You know, my novel last year, I wrote kind of a political literary magic realist thriller. I don't even know what to call it. We'll call it a political thriller, but like really just an exploration of the Israel, you know, Palestine conflict. That's the kind of thing that obsesses me, is how everything flips. You know, everything in that book is a doubling and a reversal. But yeah, I've become, I guess, with these last two books, but really interested in the idea of things both containing themselves and their absolute opposites.
Of course, we're living a life in which exactly the same thing happens. We don't decide things. They're decided for us, you know. It's like sliding doors.
Oh, my God. You know, literally, I mean, again, it's impossible for me to stay off politics, but also, it's just crazy. I mean, that somebody picked up a phone and they didn't ground the planes in America because of a phone call. Like, it's just crazy. Anyway, but, or not anyway, it's terrifying. But yes, there's definitely fiction, when you talk about no exit and stuff and existential, yes, these feel like quite existential times on so many fronts.
Yeah, it's when you were talking about heaven and hell, when Shuli in the stalls in Jerusalem meets the mother of the bridal couple, and you talk about how there's this like underground railway that's kind of instantaneous for affluent Orthodox Jews, that going from, say, New Jersey to California is just kind of like couple hours. And is that really true? Does that really happen?
I just think there's a certain connection between, and again, it's, you know, people with the means to travel that way. But there's like, you know, the like sort of direct quote in the book is that Shuli is more likely to, you know, that he bumps into someone he knows in Jerusalem, and that it's he's more like that's more natural for him to bump into someone from Brooklyn in Jerusalem than it would be for him to bump into someone from his neighborhood in Brooklyn than, say, like Madison Avenue, you know, on the Upper East Side.
Right.
And I really feel like, yes, there are certain routes that certain people travel that are common, you know, in the Orthodox community. And I feel like even that way, when I travel the world, I end up in these Jewish bubbles quite often. I was just in Moscow in December, and, you know, I don't know how many hours I was off the plane, and I was having, you know, kosher Georgian food in Moscow. Like, I, you know, it's like I was traveling. Yeah, I really feel like there are these, you know, this sort of connective tissue with a, you know, that it's what the book is looking at. This idea of home comes up a lot. What is the Jewish home? You know, this idea for Orthodoxy, that's what they're yelling at Larry when he leaves the fold, like, this is your home. But they're saying, you know, Memphis is your Jewish home, Brooklyn is your Jewish home. But it's this idea that I'm looking at in the book is, what is that home? And I do feel, yes, that's almost like, you know, a common border between, say, you know, Brooklyn and Jerusalem in that way.
Yeah, and not to put another spoiler on it, but when he tells Mary what he tells her, and at first she's totally, you know, she thinks he's totally crazy, but then she begins to think about it, and she realizes this is what you want to be close to, where everything starts when it all ends.
This is the idea of what makes our understanding, what makes our reality, like, that was such a giant thing for me. We didn't have, you know, that kind of, you know, we didn't have that money when I was growing up. We weren't the family. We never went on a big trip. You know, we never went abroad ever, not once. Like, nobody went to Israel in my family. But, like, that idea that as a religious kid, I was raised like, this is, you know, the biblical Jerusalem. Like, you know, this idea of it in Bible, in legend, in history, like, this place is just, you know, hammered into you. It is just central to your education, this idea of place, you know what I'm saying? And I don't mean in a, you know, this wasn't in the political way, this isn't, you know, it wasn't you know, a Zionist school or anything like that. I just mean in, like, the Jewish idea of the holy city, like, that was, you know, so ingrained in me. And I remember that strange dissonance when I showed up there, to be like, ah, there's the real place, like, melding the real place with this place of, like, you know, infinite story and reading and book and movie that was in my head, to, like, you know, balance the real against, you know, the, I don't know, you know, the historical, the imagined, the tradition, the all of that. So, yeah, that connection really interests me.
What's the name of the garment that Shuli was wearing and that you're buried in?
Oh, kittel.
I remember seeing my father in his casket, and he was wearing that. And, you know, he was 6'2" in real life, but for some reason, when I looked at him then, he seemed so small in death, as if it was his charisma, which he had an enormous amount, his personality, that gave him his stature. Which, is that something that's Jewish?
Oh, that's such a nice notion. Thank you for sharing that. That's so personal, but, I would say that's specific, you know, but there's so much that sits on that, you know, garment. And yes, what, I mean, that is, you know, someone's like, you know, it is, you know, it's this thing that's worn at the holidays that then, and as you're saying, then it turns into, you know, there's nothing
right.
More, you know, raw or human than that, that it turns into, you know, a burial shroud, you know?
Yeah, that was something that I pondered a lot when I read the book, because I thought exactly those thoughts. And again, it goes to the concept of, and I don't know if it's, I think you, again, when we were talking before the show, it goes again to this idea that one thing can mean so many other different things. And you were saying, I think you were saying that's kind of universal, but it does seem.
Yes. I do think it's universal. I mean, I deeply think those things are universal. Again, you know, that's for a reader to say about a specific book, but yeah, the ideas behind these things, like, I think that's what makes, you know, story function, is these, you know, core beliefs or these core ideas that are, like, what bring us all together.
Yeah, and you go, again, this is all kind of wound around the same thing, even though, as usual, I'm jumping all over the place. But when you go to the... this is kind of spoiling it. When you go to what Shuli sees when he's in Israel, that gives him the first clue to the person he's looking for. It's not really intuitive. I mean, it is intuitive, but doesn't really make that much sense. It's like, okay, I'm just going to go on this as a hunch. And that's the part where I think he's kind of goofy, but then it turns out that what he's doing is exactly right, or eventually is exactly right. You know?
He's on a journey and he's working with what he has, and you know, goofy's a sweet word. Yeah, he's truly driven, and he's, you know, he's risking it all to find what he needs. And yes, he is definitely going, you know, using his the information he has and his gut. He's definitely going by his gut, that's for sure.
Hey, so what about, you know, the Torah? And I know just enough to know that the five books of Moses are in it, and there's an enormous amount of commentary. But I wondered about that when I looked at the cover of the book, and I wondered whether you had gotten to vet the cover, or this is something the publishers came up with, because owning a bookstore, anybody can tell me that you can't judge a book by its cover, but every single person who comes into my bookstore judges the books by their covers, and that's why publishers are smart. But that cover seems to give me the sense of the Torah. I don't know if that's what you were looking at or looking for.
Oh, that's interesting. I hadn't thought that at all, but that thrills me if so. I'll take it. I hadn't even thought that. That's awesome. Now I'm going to go stare at it. I'm going to pace over to a copy. Asim, I'm just like Knopf. I've been with them my whole career in the States. My same, you know, brilliant editor, Jordan Pavlin. And anyway, but their design team is just tops and unbelievable. So, they're very kind, and I get plenty of input, but sometimes it's just so clear and so right. The first time I saw this, I just freaked out. I love this cover so much. I really love it. So yeah, I don't think there might have been the most micro tweaks that happened in design, but this is the first cover design they sent, and someone really, really got the book. You know, there's usually, or it can happen that you'll have real back and forth and you'll be hunting and trying to find the right feel and go from design to design. But this one really, I was like, it just really, really felt like the novel I'd written as soon as I saw it. And now it also has a Torah echo, according to your thing.
Well,
but it's funny. I am a big believer also. They say don't judge a book by its cover. I'm like, judge a book by its cover. You're pretty much right.
And like I said, the publishers, you know, as you said, they do a great job, and they give you sometimes, you know, depending on what author I'm interviewing, sometimes the right, you know, to say, to veto, and sometimes not. And it's very important, because I see it every single day. You know, they pick them up. They pick up the ones, unless they're picking up a book like Educated, which is now way up there on, you know, nonfiction.
Yeah, that's doing great.
Yeah. But, you know, otherwise, if they don't know the book, it's just picking it up, and whether it's texture.
It's a very scary world.
Or even deckled edges. I mean...
Who doesn't love a deckled edge?
Right, really. It just costs more money, that's all. And so it's whether they trust you.
But I think they're seeing that people like a nice book. That sounded like a nice rye bread. But yeah, I think, you know, people appreciate those things, you know, if you have a... As you said, physical books and a library. I keep my books for my whole life. So.
Yeah, part of this book, part of our interview is a little bit like a Seinfeld episode, a little bit.
That's
right. A nice challah, yeah. And then when George is hauling it up with the fishing line on.
That's funny, exactly.
I know. I guess in closing, you seem to be just... you know, this voice on the other end of the line, but you seem to be just as paradoxical as a lot of the things you're talking about. You say you're the most un-Jewish person, your friends say you're the most Jewish person, you obviously know your stuff because You do. I mean, the book is very clear. So what's the deal?
Oh, yeah, and I was going to say, it's not that I say, there's no way for me to say I'm not the most Jewish person. I am so just shockingly Jewish, but yes, religious is what we're talking about. I guess, you know, I think maybe this book comes at a really specific moment in my life, you know, where I was reflecting, you know, my father's been passed away for a decade, you know, maybe I've been, you know, thinking back to that, and also I'm a dad now, and so maybe these things that, you know, those sort of conflicts or, you know, opposites or hypocrisies that cause me no problem, like, I don't have to wrestle with what I believe. It's not been an issue. Like, I can say I'm an atheist, and I can also, you know, kiss a mezuzah every time I walk in and, you know, through a doorway or something. You know, it's that notion where, like, you know, the exact stuff that my wife and friends, you know, tease me about, where I'll literally, you know, be eating on Yom Kippur, like have a cheeseburger on Yom Kippur, but then, you know, but then I'll be like, oh, it's, you know, I don't know what, like, do the most obscure, like, you know, Jewish law that comes up, you know, like I'll bless a rainbow or something, you know, at sight of a rainbow, that kind of thing. And they'd be like, well, that's an odd choice of when this is going to come up. But I guess I just haven't, you know, I haven't had to confront those things, or it doesn't bother me to just be like, I'm not wrestling with that. You know, why, like, I don't have to come up with an answer for someone else where they'll be like, what do you believe? And they'll be like, I don't know. You know what I'm saying? Like, it's that notion, I think, maybe, you know, as my, you know, daughter gets bigger, and it's like, you know, I know to tell her, you know, like, oh, yes, we're, you know, today we're celebrating, you know, Chinese New Year, but we're not Chinese, and we're going, you know, over to this friend's, and it's Christmas, and, like, you know, we do, you know, this is our holiday, like, we can all share and celebrate each other and that kind of thing. But I think, you know, I don't know what, maybe it's like an awareness that I'm going to have some, you know, questions are going to be asked, you know, probably sooner than I expect them. And it's like, I may actually have to figure out, like, what do I believe, you know? So maybe that's what's put it in the front of my brain.
That's funny because two of my children we adopted from China, and Samantha and Annie, and I've never, ever once looked at them and thought they were Chinese. I've looked at them and thought they're my children. So I've never, ever. Right. So when I'm sitting at dinner, so for Chinese New Year, we call them adoption sisters. There was three families. We all adopted kids. So every Chinese New Year, we all get together.
And oh, that's so nice.
And we're all Jewish, too. So we go to Shunli or Shunli West. And it's just a celebration, but it could be, is it a Jewish celebration? Is it a Chinese celebration? I don't know.
Right.
And I think a good way to close this out is the fact that what you're describing when you describe yourself, at least to me, maybe not to you, is very much like the book. The paradox that is you is the paradox that you're like a gnomon of the book in a way, at least in my mind. That's all I'm saying.
As I observe, I'm like, it's not at all, that makes total sense to me. You know, like this idea, like, I, you know, separate out the fictions, but it's obviously,
you can't help,
you know,
it. Yeah.
It's, you know, it's, I think it's, you know, as I talk to you, you know, where we say, like, book comes out tomorrow, like, you know, it's an extraordinarily vulnerable thing that we do for a living. We make up stories, you know what I'm saying? I'm just telling the story, but it doesn't work unless it's completely, you know, intimate and raw and comes from down deep. So it's, you know, even if it's not in the, you know, the conscious me, like, it's the me that's talking to you, like, I also wrote the book, but it comes from some other space, but it's the same, you know, it's the same spirit. And yeah, that's, you know, of course, like, that membrane better get crossed, or it's, you know, it's not going to have sort of any life to it without it.
Yeah, that's very true. And also, in talking to you, we're both acting like, not acting, we're both, I think, being exactly what we're like. It's not like being interviewed by Terry Gross. I mean,
yeah,
yeah, we're just ourselves, and we could be hanging out in New York doing whatever we wanted to do, and at least that's the way I feel about it. But
it is a very, yes, very natural to chat with you.
And then, you know, so, yeah, I say, okay, release tomorrow. And then the other thing you got to think about is, well, okay, and really to close it, again, telling everybody that, yeah, you'll be speaking and reading from your book at the Free Library in Philadelphia on Wednesday, March 27th at 7:30. And when you do that, you know, you've now given your book to the world, and you'll be doing that again at the library. And so you give everybody the right to do what they will with it. And I've always thought, in all my interviews, I've always thought that's an interesting... You know, some authors have said they feel like they're giving away their first child. Some authors have said, oh, I don't... You know, once it's done, it's done. Some authors have been in the middle. And I can't tell how you feel about that, actually.
I can tell you how I feel about that. You know, I guess it's maybe one of my clearer and probably healthier positions, which is like, yeah, when I finish a book, when it goes to press, I'm really done with the, you know, like, my part is done. You know what I'm saying? You actually sell, when you say a publisher bought the book, I've literally sold it, like, they own it. It's not mine anymore, even to that notion. But, like, back to, you know, it going to the readers, I really do believe, like, it belongs to the readers. Like, the reader is right. Their opinions stand. Like, it doesn't matter if I write something that I think is really funny and it made someone cry, or I write something sad and they laughed at it. Like, then it's a joke. You know what I'm saying? Like, yeah. I really do. That's the one clear line in life to me, is that point of it becoming a physical book. You know, it goes out into the world and it lives its own life. And yes, I'm going to travel around and represent it. I wrote it, but, like, I really do see that it's, you know, I'm a big reader. Like, it becomes my take, my experience. That's what makes it so intimate. It's like a unique, each, you know, read is this unique, private, intimate experience. But surely, you know, how could your experience ever be anything but, you know, real and true? So, yes, I really see that space between me and the book and the book and the reader. And then I think if everything goes well, that space then gets erased and it's like a shared experience. You know, again, we were talking about intimacy. That's the point. It's like, if it works, you and I, you know, why does this, you know, call feel natural to me that you were saying, it's about a shared experience, like a shared consciousness. Like, you've been, like, I'm so thankful for that investment of your time and your brain, but you entered into this world that I built. But, you know, we can both talk about it because we both know it.
Yeah, you know, I keep saying we're going to end, but I wanted to say something else. Two things. One is, when people come into my bookstore and they're looking for a particular book, especially in the stacks and the book ladders and going up, they might find the book they're looking for, but they also see the book on the left and the book on the right. And it might be those books. It's not like the Amazon recommendations. It's just totally random. But it might be one of those books that changes their lives. And again...
Oh, I love that. I love that about found books. And, you know, and again, I, you know, maybe it is just about being old school, but, like, you know, I really do think, I mean, there's, you know, different ways to find things, but I really do think that poking around a bookstore is just a wonder. And, you know, same thing also, like, I use my digital dictionaries, but it's like the, you know, the physical, like, you find the next word over, you know what I'm saying? Yes,
exactly.
I 1,000% agree.
Okay. Well, this was great. I mean, I really could hang out and talk. I know you got things to do.
Oh, no, it's a super pleasure on this end.
Okay. Well, hopefully...
Yeah.
I was just going to say, if you ever are around here and want to see your old buddy again from Westchester, come by the bookstore and maybe we could do a reading, or maybe you could Skype in sometimes.
Oh, awesome.
Okay.
Cool. Thanks
right.
so much for your time.
Thank
what
you.
A treat.
So we were talking with Nathan Englander, whose new book is... Kaddish.com, which is funny when you name your book that, because I did look it up and it looked like the website was available. So he got Kaddish.com.com. Yeah, that was great. And it resonated with me simply because of my culture and background. And he was a great guy, and he was really interesting to me, especially because a lot of it is, like I said, in my own personal history. So what do we have coming up? We have coming up this woman, Charlie Jane Anders, who's going to discuss her new sci-fi book, The City in the Middle of the Night. I think I've spoken about this before, but it's a sci-fi book about a planet that's rotationally locked to its sun. So one side is always incredibly hot, one side is incredibly cold, and they find a way to live on the, not the perimeter, I forget what it is, the demarcation line between both day and night. And that's really good. And then Lucasta Miller will talk about her fascinating history of Letitia Elizabeth Landon, who is what was called the female Byron. It's got a really long subtitle, which I'm not going to read. And the Pulitzer Prize finalist Susan Choi, who's going to talk about her new, apparently very highly anticipated new novel. And they had an auction for the rights to it. It's called Trust Exercise. So if you want to look at this schedule or our complete schedule, you can go to the website, WellingtonSquareBooks.com, go to WCHE1520.com, or you can simply download our podcast at iTunes or Podomatic. And then there's a link at the book, the website also for both of those as well. So thanks as always for joining us. Oh, I wanted to tell you something else too. Well, first of all, he's appearing at the library like I told you, and that'll be on the 27th at 7:30. So get your tickets, go to online to the library's website. The other thing is we have this author, really good sports writer for Sports Illustrated, ESPN. His name is Rick Riley, and he wrote this book that's not anything about, well, it's a kind of about sports. It's called The Commander and Cheat, depending on how you feel about Donald Trump, and I think you know how I feel about him. It's a tongue-in-cheek look at Trump on the golf course, and the way he acts on the golf course is a real mirror to the way that he acts in real life. So he's going to give a presentation and a Q&A with the audience, and he's going to sign books as well. So join us on Thursday, April 4th from 7 to 9 at the bookshop for that. So with that, thanks so much for being here this week, and we look forward to having you guys back here next week on The Avid Reader.